face. Ruby held her breath and studied the ground with great interest. What if they were here for her? What if her work on the line had finally caught up to her? One of the Germans stopped in front of her and reached out to tilt her chin up. His leather glove felt oddly warm against her chilled skin as he turned her head from side to side, as if he was inspecting cattle. He had beady blue eyes, bushy black eyebrows, a mouth that looked too small for his face. "You," he said in deeply accented French, "your identity card." Ruby could feel the eyes of the other women on her, and for a moment she was frozen. "Schneller!" the German shouted after only a few seconds. Ruby fumbled in her handbag and withdrew her card, the real one that identified her as Ruby Benoit. The German stared at it for a moment and then looked up at her with narrowed eyes.
"Do not move."
He took a few steps to where the other Germans were standing, and as they conferred in hushed tones, examining her papers, she could feel her knees quaking. The others in line had scooted away from her as if whatever was happening to her was contagious. A few left the line altogether, disappearing down alleys when the Germans' backs were turned. Finally, the beady-eyed German returned and thrust her papers at her.
"What is your business here?"
"Queuing for barley flour," she managed.
"Do you know Adèle Beauvais?"
The name didn't ring a bell at all. Was it someone attached to the escape line, or was this purely a case of mistaken identity?
No.
"She is not your sister?"
"No, I've never heard of her, I swear."
He grabbed her chin again and held it firmly as he looked into her eyes. She refused to blink, to show him any weakness.
"Very well," he said at last.
He turned and barked something at the other Germans, and then he turned back to her.
"If I find that you are lying, I will happily shoot you in the head myself."
And then he turned sharply on his heel, followed by the other three. They got into a car a half block away, and then they were gone. Ruby collapsed to the sidewalk, breathing hard. Only one of the other women in line, a woman old enough to be Ruby's mother, came to her aid.
"Perhaps, if you know this Adèle Beauvais, you should tell her to get out while she still can,"
the woman said as she helped Ruby up. "But I've never heard of her."
"Dear," the woman said gently, "I can read on your face that you are not as innocent as you would have the Germans believe."
Ruby opened her mouth to deny it, but then the woman pressed a package into her hand.
"Here, my eggs and meat. Go home now, before the day gets any worse for you. That was a narrow escape."
"But
take it, and if you are doing something to undermine the Germans," she added in a whisper, "then thank you. Vive la France."
She turned her back on Ruby, pulling her wool coat more tightly around her. Finally, Ruby stepped out of line and began to walk back to her apartment, haunted by the fate that could have found her by accident. "Perhaps we should stop," Ruby said that night as she and Charlotte ate dinner alone in the kitchen. They were between pilots, and Lucien was out at a meeting, so it was just the two of them. Ruby had told her what had happened that day and how much it had shaken her. "Things are getting more dangerous."
"But if we stop fighting, we've already begun to lose. We have to keep at it until the very end."
"Yes, I know, but today terrified me, Charlotte. The next time the Germans come, it could be for us. Your parents didn't leave you with me, thinking that I would insert you into the fight for France."
"You didn't insert me anywhere. With or without you, I would have found my way into the resistance.
Anyhow, my parents couldn't have imagined how the world would change.
My father left our apartment a year and a half ago, thinking that the police would let him go because it was the right thing to do."
"He didn't get to stay here long enough to change his mind.
But he would have, Ruby. He would have seen the need to fight back. He just didn't realize yet what would happen to the city he loved."
"But the risk," Ruby began.
"The risk is part of it," Charlotte said firmly. "Nothing great happens without risk."
"I know. I just can't help feeling as if our luck is running out." Over the next several weeks, the arrivals and departures of pilots flowed like a steady tide. There were Refilwe and Poloko, two pilots from South Africa who arrived together, conspicuous in both their accents and their appearances. They were two of the most polite pilots Ruby took in, but she was glad when they departed after only 2 days, for they would have been harder to pass off as Frenchmen if the authorities came looking. There was a pilot named Travis from New Zealand, whose charming accent made Charlotte giggle. And there was a pilot named Raymond from Worthington, Ohio, whose sister had gone to university in New York at the same time Ruby had. Howie from Topeka was with them for almost a week, and he spent evenings patiently helping Charlotte practice her English verb conjugations, and mornings sipping watery ersatz coffee with Ruby in companionable silence. Terence from Liverpool was worried about whether his fiancée Elizabeth would stay faithful to him when he was gone.
"She has legs that go on for miles," he said more than once, "and don't think that the other men don't notice. She's always flirting, but she swears she loves me. Do you think she's telling the truth?"
Marcus from Arlington, Texas, was disturbed that Ruby and Charlotte were involved in the escape line.
"But you're women," he said, looking baffled. "This is dangerous work, which means it should be done by men."
Still, he thanked them profusely for their hospitality, and was never rude. But Ruby was happy to see him go when Lul, whom they had recruited for the new escape line, came to pick him up. Ernest from Spring Gully, South Carolina, had such a thick southern accent that Ruby could hardly understand him, and Joseph, from Brockton, Massachusetts, came down with a fever and murmured for 2 days straight about someone named Catherine, whom he called the love of his life. Fortunately, he came out of the fog on the third day and was in traveling shape by the fourth, having sweated out the illness under Ruby's concerned supervision. All the pilots brought welcome news of Allied victories and spoke of the hope that the war would be over soon. The Germans were being pushed back on every front. "France will be liberated any day now," a pilot from St. Louis named Tom Truba told Ruby confidently in late February. "You wait and see. The war'll be over by the end of 44.
He departed with Lur the next day, leaving Charlotte and Ruby alone once again. Charlotte went out in the late morning to meet Lucien, and after Ruby returned from exchanging the day's ration tickets, she sat down in the living room, basking in the rare silence. She hadn't been feeling well for the past few weeks, which she attributed to the doldrums of winter and the constant pit of worry in her stomach over Thomas's safety. But today, alone for the first time in weeks, she had time to truly think about how she'd been feeling and when the symptoms had first appeared. As she sat on the couch in silence, her stomach swimming, something suddenly occurred to her. She hadn't had her time of the month since December, more than 2 months ago. "Oh my God," she said aloud. And all at once, she knew. The pit in her stomach, the lack of appetite even when she should have been starving, the swelling in her breasts, even as her belly grew flatter, it was exactly what had happened last time. She was pregnant. The realization hit her like a lightning bolt, and she didn't know whether to be ecstatic or terrified. It was what she and Thomas had spoken of, the life they had planned together. But she wasn't ready for the future to come yet. At the same time, though, what if the pilots were right and the war would be over soon? She was carrying Thomas's baby. The thought echoed in her head again and again, like a favorite song, soothing and thrilling her. This meant that a piece of him was still here. But she'd lost the first baby. What if she was fated to miscarry again? Losing this baby, too, might just destroy her. She felt a sudden, desperate need to protect the life in her womb at any cost. But how could she bring a healthy child into the world when she could scarcely survive herself? She sat with her hands on her belly for the next few hours, imagining a future with Thomas and the child they now shared. She knew, with the same certainty that she'd known her first baby would be a boy, that this child would be a little girl. She could see Thomas laughing and chasing a pigtailed daughter through the poppy fields, with the sky clear and blue and perfect above them. Ruby would watch from the porch, her heart filled with joy as she thought about how far they'd come. The war would be over, the world would be right again, and everyone she loved would be safe. Charlotte would be there too, sitting beside her on a rocking chair, finally protected from all the forces that could hurt her.
"Are you okay?" Charlotte's voice jarred Ruby awake sometime later. Ruby didn't remember falling asleep, but darkness had fallen.
Oh, yes, Ruby said, struggling upright. I must have been more tired than I realized.
Charlotte frowned.
You're feeling all right?
Yes. Ruby was suddenly aware of how much older Charlotte looked lately. She was 15 now. The innocent girl Ruby had first met nearly 5 years ago had vanished, replaced by a young woman. Would Charlotte's own parents recognize the person their daughter had become?
Is there anything you'd like to talk about? Charlotte asked, sitting down beside Ruby.
Ruby lowered her eyes and shook her head. When she looked up again, the girl was staring at her knowingly. Charlotte's gaze moved to Ruby's belly, and Ruby was startled to realize that her own hands had returned there, apparently of their own accord, as if she could shield the baby against all the evil in the world.
You're pregnant, aren't you?
Charlotte's tone was gentle.
What? You're pregnant? I didn't even realize it myself until a few hours ago, Ruby said, her voice shaking. How did you know?
Charlotte looked sad.
Because you're peaceful, just like you were the last time. It's like...
She paused, searching for words.
It's like it doesn't matter what's going on around you. You're just calm.
Calm, Ruby repeated, and as implausible as it sounded, she understood what Charlotte meant. Over the past month, she'd felt her energy turn inward. She had worried less about the pilots and the state of the war, and had concentrated more on the memories that she carried with her, as if they would provide her a means of survival. Now she recognized what Charlotte had already seen, that she'd been nesting before she even knew there was a need.
I'm very frightened, Charlotte, she said after a moment. What if I lose this baby, too? You won't? How can you know that? I just do. This is what's meant to be, Ruby. You're meant to raise a child with Thomas.
Ruby half smiled. You don't judge me for having relations with him?
Of course not. You would marry him right now if you could, wouldn't you?
Ruby could see in her mind's eye a church somewhere, maybe in England, maybe in California, a white dress, and Thomas standing handsome and tall at the altar in an RAF dress uniform, waiting for her. Her favorite love song, Cheek to Cheek, would play afterward as all their loved ones celebrated, and they'd hold each other and dance long into the night.
Yes, I would. Then God knows how you feel. This war, it has changed everything about the world. But our most important lives are still on the inside, aren't they? What matters is what's in your heart.
When did you get so wise? Ruby's eyes were suddenly wet. Charlotte leaned forward and kissed Ruby on her cheek. Then she placed a hand gently on Ruby's belly.
Someone I love very much set a good example for me.
You mustn't tell anyone, Charlotte. Not even Lucien. I don't want anyone to know until I've told Thomas.
Your secret is safe, at least until your belly begins to grow. But maybe the war will be over by that time, and Thomas will have returned.
There was a knock at the door then, and Charlotte went to peer out the peephole.
Another pilot, she said,
and Ruby nodded, wiping her tears away. She took a deep breath and stood, ready to greet the newest fugitive. Their work had to go on. It was her duty to do everything she could to build a better world for the child she already loved with all her heart and soul. The new arrests began in March. At first, there was the rumor that a man who had worked on Aubert's original escape line had been arrested and executed for trying to smuggle pilots out of France. Soon after, Laure was picked up, questioned, and released. But she got word to Ruby through a friend of Lucien's that she wouldn't be working as a courier for the new line anymore, because she was certain the Germans were following her. She could think of no other reason why they would have let her out so quickly. Ruby, whose belly was just beginning to blossom, grew increasingly nervous. She knew Laure hadn't talked, but what if the authorities had been following her long before they picked her up? What if they'd seen her coming and going from Ruby's apartment? The risks seemed enormous, but after a few weeks passed and no more arrests were carried out, Ruby began to relax. Perhaps the first arrest had been a terrible fluke, and Laure's had been a mistake. Besides, by early April, there was buzz about a possible Allied invasion in the next few weeks. Surely the Germans would be more worried about that.
"We still need to lie low," Ruby said to Charlotte and Lucien over dinner one night. "Even if things seem to be turning in favor of the Allies."
"You mean stop taking in pilots?" Charlotte asked.
Ruby hesitated. Her gut was telling her yes. But what would happen to the men who needed refuge? She couldn't simply abandon them.
"We just need to be more careful, I think."
Lucien and Charlotte exchanged uneasy looks.
"Ruby," Lucien said after a moment, "I can take in pilots in my apartment for a while, just until things blow over, in case your apartment has been compromised."
"No," Ruby said firmly, "we have the perfect setup here with Monsieur Savatier looking out for us, and with the hidden closet in my bedroom wall. We just need to hang on a little longer, and the Allies will be here. We're nearly at the end. I can feel it."
Within a few weeks, Ruby was escorting pilots on foot to the Montparnasse station. Though it put her out in the open, it just made sense, now that Laure was unavailable. It lessened the traffic in and out of her apartment, nearly eliminated her contact with others on the escape line, and allowed her to see the pilots safely off on the next step of their journey. In fact, Ruby wondered why she hadn't started doing this sooner. Fewer people involved in the line meant fewer chances for something to go wrong. And now that the threat of Allied invasion was looming, the German troops in Paris seemed distracted anyhow. Surely they wouldn't notice a woman who was simply out for a stroll on a spring afternoon. Her charge the second week of April was an American pilot named Christopher. He had graduated from the University of Florida before joining the army, and he was as clever as he was friendly. When he'd first shown up at her door 2 days earlier, Ruby had assumed that he was French, because he had somehow managed to acquire a set of worn clothes that fit perfectly, as well as a Frenchman's particular way of holding a cigarette. He'd even greeted her in French, and it had taken several seconds for her to notice his American accent. Perhaps that was why, as she strolled down the Rue Letellier on a bright morning, trailed by Christopher a half block behind, she hadn't thought to worry. Some pilots were more foolhardy than others. Some resisted listening to a woman's counsel. Some were simply clumsy and nervous. But Christopher was a model guest, and Ruby was sure she'd have him to his train in no time. She was so confident, in fact, that when a large black car drew to an abrupt halt beside her, she hardly noticed. But then, three men jumped out, all dressed in the uniform of the German police, and Ruby's heart shot into her throat. Surely they weren't here for Christopher. She reminded herself to continue walking, to keep her head down. But two of the men stepped directly into her path, and the other cut off her only potential route of escape by coming up behind her.
"Identity papers," said the broader of the two men in front of her. He had a nasty scar across his cheek and a short dark mustache that made him look like Hitler.
"Yes, of course," Ruby said, trying to sound calm. From the corner of her eye, she could see Christopher turn down a side street behind her.
The police didn't seem to notice him, which filled her with some relief. But it was short-lived. Why were they stopping her if it wasn't because of the pilot? She rummaged in her purse and withdrew her papers. She carried only her real ones now, the ones that identified her as Ruby Benoit. She was sure that even if the Germans had something on her, they wouldn't execute her for fear of reprisal from the U.S. government. It was her trump card, but perhaps she was being overly optimistic.
"This says you were born in the United States," the mustached officer said, glaring at her. "What are you doing here?"
"I am French by marriage."
"Where are you going?"
"Just out for a stroll." She could tell by the look on his face that it was the wrong answer. "I needed to stretch my legs." He frowned.
"What is your address?"
24 Rue Amélie. She gave him the old address without hesitation, because she didn't want anything to lead to the new apartment. Charlotte was there, and Ruby wouldn't put her in danger.
"Most people out for a stroll would walk toward the river," the officer said.
"I wanted to be alone," she replied. "There are crowds near the river on a beautiful day like today."
"So, you were not going to the Montparnasse station," he said with a smirk, "to aid in the escape of Allied pilots?"
Ruby could feel her mouth go dry, but she forced a neutral expression.
"What?
Of course not.
And you are certain that's the story you want to stick with?
I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
He grabbed her handbag and began to rifle through. Her mind spun as she wondered whether she'd mistakenly left anything incriminating in it. She didn't think so. But a moment later, he withdrew a bundle of ration tickets.
You live with your husband?
His expression told her he already knew that Marcel was dead.
No, he died in 1941.
Yes, I am aware. The traitor Marcel Benoit.
Ruby swallowed hard. So she hadn't been stopped on a whim. They had sought her out. This was much worse. My husband wasn't a traitor. The evidence against him was false. The officer guffawed.
Madame, we do not make mistakes. But you, it seems, have made a serious one. Why do you have so many ration tickets if you live alone?
She thought quickly. I offered to pick up some supplies for neighbors.
Ah, and these neighbors, as you call them, are not allied pilots trying to escape from France?
Of course not.
Ruby tried to appear indignant.
Ah, yes, I'd nearly forgotten. You're merely out for a walk.
He grabbed her by the arm and shoved her toward the car. The other officer, who'd been in front of her, took her other arm, while the man who'd been behind her walked around to the driver's seat.
What are you doing? Ruby demanded. I have rights.
The men laughed as they shoved her roughly into the back of the car. The mustached man climbed in beside her.
Unfortunately for you, madame, that isn't true at all.
At the police headquarters, Ruby was thrown into a small cell by herself and told to wait. She spent the day worrying about Charlotte. What if the police found out where Ruby lived now? What if Charlotte was arrested? Ruby still felt confident that her own American citizenship would spare her from execution. But if they found Charlotte, it would be only a matter of time until they realized she was Jewish. How had Ruby allowed her to participate in something so dangerous? The guilt overwhelmed her, and she sat on the floor sobbing until nightfall, when a guard came to retrieve her, yanking her to her feet and hauling her into a room that looked like an office. Inside, she found two uniformed guards waiting for her.
"Tell us everything you know," one of them said without preamble.
"If you lie to us, you'll be shot first thing in the morning."
Ruby struggled to keep a neutral face. Her hands went to her belly. "Breathe," she reminded herself. "Stay calm. They have nothing on you or you'd already be dead."
"I haven't done anything," she said evenly. "You have made a mistake. I am American. You can't execute me."
The guard shrugged.
"Have it your way."
A female guard entered a moment later with a bologna sandwich and a cup of water, and though Ruby worried that the food had been drugged, she wolfed it down. She was starving. Soon after, another guard came in and dragged her to a cold, damp cell with a straw mattress on a dirt floor.
"Get some sleep," he said, not unkindly, and then he closed and locked the door behind her.
Chapter 37. April 1944.
Ruby has been arrested. Lucien's face was pale when he arrived at Charlotte's door that night,
far later than she'd expected him. She had been pacing the apartment, worried sick that Ruby hadn't come home. The last Charlotte had heard, Ruby was on her way to deliver Christopher, the American pilot, to the Montparnasse station. Had he been careless? Followed her too closely? Drawn unwanted attention to both of them. Charlotte had been bracing for the worst as the hours rolled by with no sign of Ruby, but Lucien's words still broke her.
"No, no, no." Charlotte was suddenly unable to breathe. "There must be a mistake. Lucien, tell me there's a mistake."
He shook his head slowly.
"There is no mistake, my dear. The Fell Gendarmerie picked her up hours ago. She's to be turned over to the Gestapo in the morning." "No, Lucien, how did this happen?"
Lucien didn't reply until after he'd stepped into the apartment and she'd closed the door behind them.
"Someone must have betrayed her. They knew exactly who she was when they stopped her. From what I understand, they didn't even notice the pilot tailing her. He made it to his rendezvous point at the station. He's the one who told us of her arrest."
"Did they hurt her?"
"I don't know." He took her hands. "But, Charlotte, Ruby is strong. She will survive whatever they throw at her. and they won't dare execute her because she is an American. She will survive.
But she's pregnant, Charlotte whispered.
All the remaining color seemed to drain from Lucien's face.
What?
Charlotte began to cry. She had promised Ruby that she'd keep her secret, but things were very different now.
If the Germans find out...
Thomas is the father?
Yes.
The pregnancy isn't visible yet?
Not really.
Ruby's belly had begun to swell, but not enough that someone who didn't know her would take notice.
That's good. But if she's sent east...
Lucien's voice trailed off, and he and Charlotte exchanged horrified looks.
They kill the pregnant ones first, Charlotte said, her voice hollow. That's what I've heard.
Let's just hope for now that it does not come to that. I will try tomorrow to find out everything I can about our situation, he paused. In the meantime, I think you should stay with me. If they've arrested Ruby, it's only a matter of time before the trail leads to this apartment. I will speak with Monsieur Sabatier about removing anything incriminating. But for now, Charlotte, we must go. Quickly. Charlotte wiped her eyes and nodded. It was only a place, after all. What was important was that they all found a way to survive.
I will do everything in my power to make sure she's okay, Lucien said, as if reading her mind.
Thank you, Charlotte replied.
But the words felt hollow, because she knew he could do only so much. For now, Ruby was on her own, and her fate rested in the hands of the increasingly hostile German authorities. Charlotte couldn't sleep that night, but she dozed off after dawn, falling into an abyss of nightmares. At first, she could see Ruby at the bottom of a dark hole, crying out for help. And then, she was on a crowded train car headed east. In the third dream, she saw Ruby delivering a stillborn baby in a dirty jail cell. When Charlotte awoke, sweaty and panting, Lucien was gone, and she was alone. He returned late that afternoon, his expression grim.
I've spoken with Monsieur Sabatier, he said. We cleared out the hidden closet.
If the Germans come, they won't find anything out of the ordinary. Monsieur Sabatier will contact me if Ruby returns or if anyone comes looking for her.
Thank you, Charlotte hesitated. Is there any word about what has happened to her?
Lucien cleared his throat.
She has been moved to the prison at Fresnes.
Fresnes?
I'm afraid so.
They didn't say anything for a moment, but Charlotte knew that Lucien was thinking the same thing she was. This was a bad sign. The conditions were reportedly horrific. People passing by could hear the screams of tortured prisoners.
Have you learned anything else? Charlotte asked.
Just that a man named Leo Hue disappeared at the same time, and hasn't turned up in any of the prisons as far as we can tell. He was working on the escape line, and the suspicion is that he betrayed Ruby and a few others. Laure has also been apprehended, as has another man who ran a safe house just outside Paris.
And have any of them talked yet?
Not as far as I know, but the Nazis have their techniques.
Will they torture her?
I don't know.
But from the way Lucien averted his eyes, Charlotte guessed that the answer was probably yes. She felt suddenly sick to her stomach.
Surely the fact that she is American will help her.
Yes, I hope so, Lucien said, but his tone was flat and unconvincing. Charlotte, if there's a way to survive, Ruby will. I know she will.
Yes, Charlotte agreed.
But she also knew that survival might not be a possibility. There was no reason to say it aloud. Chapter 38. June 1944. From Dartmouth, Thomas and the other two British pilots who'd made their escape from Plua in January had been escorted to London by two MPs, who took them first to the movement's office and then to the Ministry of Defense. There, Thomas had been grilled for hours by an MI9 man who was evidently trying to confirm that Thomas was who he said he was.
You never know,
the man said at the end when he was assured that Thomas was telling the truth.
It wouldn't be the first time the Germans have tried to infiltrate us. Welcome back, son.
The interrogation was followed by 14 days of mandatory leave, which Thomas was supposed to use to get his head straight, according to the MI9 man. But he didn't want to straighten out his head. He wanted to return to the skies. He wanted to defend Britain. He wanted to drive those damned Nazis out of France. He wanted to get back to Ruby. It was clear, however, that none of that was going to happen immediately, so he accepted an invitation to visit Harry's family for a week, although he left after just 4 days, because Harry's mother hovered over him, staring as if he were a ghost. He knew she could see shadows of her son in him, in the way he carried himself, the way he spoke, the way he walked, and he realized how difficult his visit was for her. So he made his excuses and spent the rest of his leave alone in a small hotel room in London, dreaming of the day he'd make it back to Ruby. Sometimes, when he closed his eyes, he could see poppies. It was the only time he felt a sense of peace. Thomas received word on the last day of his leave that instead of returning to Northolt, he was to report to RAF headquarters for a new posting.
"Won't I go back to my old squadron?"
Thomas asked the movements officer, whose office he was shown into upon arrival.
"No," said the man, who introduced himself as Roscoe Vincent. "I'm afraid you can no longer take part in ops over Europe." "Pardon?"
Thomas's stomach was suddenly in free fall.
"The regulations have changed,"
Vincent continued as he studied Thomas's file, which was open on the desk in front of him.
"You see, if you were to be shot down and captured by the Germans, you'd be in a position to give them information about the escape line. We can't risk that."
"But I would never do that. I swear it."
Vincent was unmoved.
"Of course you don't think you would. But no one really knows how they'd hold up under torture, eh? In any case, those are the rules and there's nothing I can do about that. Now, shall we talk about where to post you? Perhaps you might like to fly Lysanders in a unit that handles air-to-air firing practices."
"No," Thomas resisted the urge to squirm in his chair. "I need to be back in combat."
"Then Malta?"
"I wouldn't really be making an impact in the war effort there, now would I?"
Vincent sighed and made a note in Thomas's file.
"The RAF base in Drem, then. You can fly missions in North Africa."
"With all due respect, sir, I'd like to be as involved in the campaign in Europe as possible."
Vincent peered at Thomas over the top rim of his glasses.
"Why?"
Thomas hesitated.
"The people of France saved my life. I vowed to myself that if I got out alive, I would do all I could to protect them."
Vincent studied him for a long time.
"So, you met a girl?"
Thomas didn't say anything. He didn't want to hurt his case.
"Europe isn't an option."
Vincent marked something in Thomas's file and then flipped it closed with finality.
"We'll start you at Ras Alma in Morocco. It's being used as a staging post for now. From there, I suspect you'll be heading to..."
He checked his notes.
"Oujda, also in Morocco. Rest assured, you'll be a very important part of the war effort. That will be all."
He stood and waited until Thomas, the breath knocked out of him, rose and made his way to the door. The poppy fields felt farther away than ever, but he was powerless to change that. If he needed to help win the war from the edge of Africa, that's what he would do. After all, the base in Morocco wasn't far from the European coast. And that was something. It turned out that instead of flying combat missions, Thomas's assignment was to deliver Spitfires to airfields in Corsica through the heat of the summer. The aircrafts would be used in the upcoming liberation of France, so Thomas was able to rationalize to himself that, in a way, he was protecting Ruby after all, even if he wasn't doing so directly. But he longed to fly missions, and as the weeks rolled into months, he began to feel as if he would be stranded in Morocco forever. On June 6th, Thomas was on another continent as more than 160,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches of Normandy to fight the Nazis head-on. The men storming through northern France were a mere 170 miles from Ruby, and he wasn't there. Thomas took a short assignment in midsummer, training other RAF pilots to evade capture if they went down behind enemy lines. The tide of the war had changed after D-Day, and it was becoming clear that the Nazis wouldn't be able to hold on. Still, they seemed to be hunting downed pilots ruthlessly. It was more important than ever for pilots flying over the continent to know what to do if they had to eject over land.
"There are good people on the ground there," Thomas said to a group of fresh-faced young men in late June. "People who rise above the danger and risk their own lives to help us. It's why we will win the war, because the things we stand for are rooted in that sort of goodness."
"How do you maintain your faith in humanity, sir?" asked a young pilot. "How should we go about believing that we will get home safely when the odds are against us from the moment we hit the ground?"
"You must think of the people you love the most," Thomas said, "and remember that you're fighting the war to make the world safe for them. Whatever becomes of you, whether you live or die, you'll know that you are doing things for the right reasons. That's how you maintain your faith."
Chapter 39. June 1944. Ruby was still imprisoned at Fresnes when she heard the news of the Allied invasion of Normandy. The end of the war, it seemed, was at hand. But how long would it take for the Allies to reach Paris? Would she survive that long? 5.5 months into her pregnancy, her belly was growing, but the guards hadn't noticed yet. In fact, they hardly seemed to notice her at all anymore. They'd tried to force the names of her associates out of her when they first captured her, but she'd maintained a steadfast denial, repeating that they were wrong, that she'd never worked for the resistance, that she had no idea what they were talking about. She suspected the only reason she hadn't been tortured or executed was that she was American. Home was now a whitewashed cell, 10 feet long and 6 feet across, with an iron cot attached to the wall and an open toilet in the corner. Every day, weak coffee was handed out in the morning, and just before noon, the soup cart came by. The same bland potage was served at dinner, along with a small piece of bread. The prisoners were given minuscule amounts of cheese or meat twice a week, and sometimes there were Red Cross food parcels filled with treats like chocolate jam and crackers. Some prisoners received clothing or food from relatives, but of course, Charlotte couldn't come forward with a delivery without revealing herself. Ruby received packages just twice from her cousin, Lucien, who wrote that his wife was fine and in good spirits. She knew it was his way of telling her that Charlotte was alive and well, and that knowledge brought her far more comfort and warmth than the wool socks and bread he sent. Twice a week, the prisoners were taken into the courtyard for 20 minutes of exercise. Communication with prisoners from other cell blocks was forbidden, but Ruby was heartened to catch glimpses of Lo twice during the first few weeks. After that, the raven-haired courier was gone, and Ruby had no way of knowing whether she'd been released, sent east, or executed. She prayed for the first, but knew the last was far more likely. Ruby found she could communicate with the prisoners in the adjoining cells by speaking close to the faucets. Somehow, the pipes went through the walls and carried sound next door. She learned that the woman to her right was a 23-year-old named Angelique, accused of helping to distribute a resistance newsletter. To her left was Jacqueline, who was 42 and suspected only of being the girlfriend of a man who worked on one of the escape lines. Both women refused to admit any wrongdoing, and they were beaten regularly for it. Ruby found strength in their steadfast resistance, and she tried to draw upon that inspiration in her darkest hours. And there were many dark hours. She was by herself for most of the day. But she wasn't really alone, for she had the baby in her belly. Thomas's baby, her source of strength. And if she was grateful to the Germans for anything, it was that they never tried to starve her as a tactic to make her talk. They took away every other freedom they could, but the fact that she was still able to feed herself meant that her baby was able to grow. At night, when she couldn't sleep, she sang softly to her belly and hoped that the baby wasn't somehow absorbing her fears. She prayed for a better life for her child, and she begged God each night to continue to conceal the pregnancy. There were 4 women who had babies with them and had been allowed to remain at Fresnes, but still, Ruby hesitated to give up her secret. She didn't know what the other women had been accused of, but she suspected their alleged transgressions were more minor than hers, for the guards left them alone. In mid-June, she was moved to the prison at Romainville, on the edge of Paris, which sent chills down her spine. She knew that this was the place where prisoners were taken before being deported to Germany. On the way into the prison, she had to sit down with one of the commanders, a hulking Nazi soldier who looked blank and unsympathetic, as he quickly skimmed her file. "I'm American," she said, trying to sound confident. "You can't send me east. I have rights." He merely laughed and said, "None of you have rights. Haven't you worked that out by now?" For a week and a half, she languished in a cell with 9 other women, all of whom were just as worried as she was about what was coming next. Romainville should have seemed a pleasure after Frin. After all, they were allowed to socialize with each other, and their cells even had windows, which looked out on the prison yard. But the 4 a.m. roll call each day ruined any chance Ruby had at happiness. Every morning, the prisoners were marched into the prison yard, and 30 or 40 names were read out. These women were on the list to be deported east, and most of them stepped forward with heads held high. Some shouted, "Vive la France!" and others simply smiled bravely and waved goodbye. All of them seemed to be facing the future with courage. Ruby didn't know how they did it. And then, on June 25th, her name was called. She didn't dare look back at the others for fear of crying. She felt so much weaker than they were. She wanted to scream and rage and cry out that this wasn't fair, that this was France, that the Germans had no right to take her away. But there would be no point in any of that, and she knew it. She was on her own. Ruby was loaded onto a bus full of other women, all of whom were silent as they made their way through the familiar streets of Paris. Ruby stared out the window and searched the faces of passers-by, hoping against hope to see Charlotte, or Lucien, or even Monsieur Sabatier. But of course it was only a sea of strangers, many of them staring with detachment, as if the same couldn't possibly happen to them. At the Gare de Ponta on the northeast edge of the city, the SS shoved the women into trains, 60 to a car. There was straw on the floor and very little ventilation from the tiny slit windows above. There was an air of fear as they pulled out of the station, and soon that fear was tinged with the pungent scent of urine from the overflowing tin toilet in the corner. For the next few days, the train stopped frequently, sometimes for hours at a time as it chugged slowly east. Twice a day, the prisoners were let out briefly with armed guards standing by to relieve themselves in fields. A few tried to flee, but they were shot dead on the spot. Ruby simply tried to blend in with the others, hiding her belly as the transport drew closer to the German border. There were rumors that children and pregnant women were being shot upon arrival at the concentration camps. She didn't know if this was true, but she couldn't risk anyone noticing her condition. As long as she was still in France, as long as she could hear bombs dropping in the distance, Ruby held on to the hope that they could be rescued. Then, on June 30th, her mother's birthday, the train passed through the eastern French city of Nancy, and finally, inevitably, into Germany. Once the French border had disappeared behind them, Ruby's heart sank. They were in Hitler's land now, and as they rolled further into Nazi territory, Ruby felt a heavy sense of certainty. There would be no reprieve. She had to do all she could to protect herself and her child until the Allies came. Ravensbrück, the camp where Ruby and the other prisoners were taken, was hot. Blisteringly hot. On the day of their arrival, Ruby and the other women were marched through a town called Fürstenberg, some 50 miles north of Berlin, up and down dusty hills and winding roads, until they finally reached the enormous green gates of an expansive prison camp. Barracks seemed to stretch as far as the eye could see, and the women who were already imprisoned there walked back and forth, pushing carts and pulling wagons, with hollow eyes, sunken cheeks, and emaciated limbs. It was like something out of a Bela Lugosi horror movie, and Ruby had to pinch herself as a reminder that, in fact, this was real life. Her life. Her stomach lurched, and she had to bite her tongue to avoid vomiting in the dirt. Ruby was horrified when the arriving prisoners were ordered into a huge building and told to undress. What if someone noticed her belly? But a heavy woman who had been near her on the train moved toward her as they entered the building and took her arm. "You are pregnant," the woman whispered in French. Ruby hesitated. "Is it obvious? Tears clouded her vision. Had she been fooling herself to think she could get away with concealing it?
"Stand behind me," the woman said firmly. "We will not let them see. We cannot let them see."
"Thank you," Ruby whispered. She held her breath as she cowered, naked and terrified, behind the woman.
"I have 2 daughters of my own," the woman said softly as they inched forward. "They are around your age. I pray every day for their survival. As a mother, it is the most important thing in the world, is it not?"
"Yes," Ruby managed. "Yes, it is." Ruby shuffled with the rest of the prisoners through several stations, where they were ordered to hand over their clothes, their jewelry, and all their belongings to the guards. In another room, she was forcibly separated from the kind woman and told to climb onto a table. She wanted to scream as a hawk-faced female guard probed between her legs, but the exam was a cursory one, and as Ruby was ushered on, quaking with relief, she realized that every woman who came into the room was being subjected to the same indignity. The guards were checking to make sure they hadn't hidden any valuables inside their body. Next, Ruby fell into a line to have her head shaved, and she sobbed as her auburn hair fell in glossy ringlets to the floor. The tears earned her a slap across the face, and then, nearly bald and shivering, she was sent into another room, where she was shoved under a shower, handed a tiny towel, and given a pair of dirty underpants and a thin cotton dress, with an X sewn onto both the back and the front. She saw the kind woman again as the prisoners were herded into the huge barrack that would become their home. There were dirty straw mattresses, roughly 5 feet wide, arranged in bunk formations 3 high, and the women were told they would be sleeping 3 to a bed. The older woman sidled over to a dazed Ruby and took her hand.
"You are all right?" she asked.
Ruby could only nod. She still couldn't understand how the physical examination had failed to reveal her condition.
"Thank God for that," the woman said. "He must have heard our prayers."
But as the days turned into weeks, Ruby began to wonder whether God could hear them at all here, or whether all of Germany was somehow a void from which no prayers could escape. She was sent to work at first on a crew that leveled sand dunes. It was hard, grueling labor under the watchful gaze of a female guard with a face like a bulldog's. They worked for nearly 12 hours each day with very few breaks, and Ruby worried constantly that the food she was given wouldn't be enough to keep the baby alive. Every day, she inhaled a small amount of rutabaga or beet soup, a tiny portion of bread, and some watery grain coffee. Once a week, the meager rations were supplemented with a slice of sausage or an ounce of cheese. Ruby knew she was losing weight quickly. Her belly was still growing, and she was relieved to know that the baby, at least, was receiving some nourishment. But it came at Ruby's expense. The only saving grace was that with the near starvation, Ruby's pregnancy wasn't readily apparent, although it should have been by now. On her second week at Ravensbrück, Ruby's dorm was flooded with 2 dozen new arrivals, women from Russia who came in with their freshly shorn heads held high. At first, the French women Ruby had arrived with bristled at the intrusion, and Ruby was afraid that there would be an argument. But one of the Russians, a young woman named Nadia, whose high cheekbones and clear green eyes distinguished her as beautiful even in this hellhole, spoke French and managed to diffuse any misunderstanding.
"We are all in the same situation," she said in a tone that was impossibly soothing. "We are friends, all of us, united against a common enemy. Let us work together."
On the third day after the Russians arrived, Nadia approached Ruby.
"You are not French, yet you are with the French prisoners. Why?"
"I'm American," Ruby said, "but I've lived in France for several years now." "Why?" Nadia asked again, her gaze sharp and penetrating. "I married a Frenchman, and when the war started, I couldn't bear to leave. I didn't realize that things would get so bad."
"If you were to do it over again, would you go home before the war began?"
"No. I think perhaps I did some good before I was arrested." Ruby also knew that if she'd gone home, she would never have helped save Charlotte, or met Lucien or Thomas, and she wouldn't be carrying Thomas's baby right now. The way things had unfolded felt predestined somehow, even if she couldn't imagine the reason.
"And you are here. Why?"
Nadia's questions were unrelenting, but her eyes had turned kinder. "I was arrested on suspicion of being part of an underground escape line for Allied pilots."
"And are the accusations true?"
Ruby smiled slightly.
"Of course not."
But the look they exchanged told a different story, and Ruby knew that Nadia understood. Ruby had put her neck out and had been caught, something she could never admit aloud.
"I see," Nadia said.
"And you? Why are you here?" The woman smiled.
"I, too, was accused of helping people to escape. Of course I confess nothing, but there are perhaps 500 men who might tell a different story."
Ruby stared at her. Was she saying she had helped 500 men escape the Nazis? "Well," Ruby said at last, "it is good we are both so honest and obedient. Just think what would have happened if we'd actually been involved in undermining the enemy."
Nadia grinned. "Yes, just think."
The next morning, when they were given their rations for the day, Nadia sidled up beside Ruby and pressed half of her bread into Ruby's hand. "Why?" Ruby asked, trying to hand the bread back. "You need your strength, too." But Nadia turned away, smiling at Ruby over her shoulder.
"There are two of you," she said, glancing at Ruby's belly, "and only one of me."
She had disappeared into a swarm of other prisoners by the time Ruby recovered enough to respond. Was her pregnancy really that obvious by now? And if so, why hadn't the guards noticed? She wasn't sure if she could, in good conscience, accept another woman's bread. But she was hungry, so hungry. Nadia was already gone. And surely, just this once, it would be okay. Ruby stuffed the bread into her mouth before she could change her mind, and as she set off for the dunes with the rest of her work crew, she touched her belly and hoped her baby was getting the nourishment she needed to survive. In late July, Ruby, Nadia, and 16 other women were taken out of the camp to the nearby Siemens factory beyond the south wall to interview for temporary jobs.
"They are taking women who are clever," Nadia whispered to Ruby on the way. "The rumor is that these are skilled labor positions. Pay attention, Ruby, for this will be much better than the work we've been doing."
Ruby knew that Nadia's concern came from the fact that Ruby's belly was swelling more obviously beneath the loose cotton of her dress now, though she still managed to conceal her condition from the guards by rounding her shoulders and leaning forward slightly during roll call. She was nearly 7 months along, and there would come a time soon when her body could no longer rise to the demands of the daily physical labor. Factory work would be much less taxing. It was, she realized with the surge of panic, the only chance she had of saving herself and her baby.
"Do you know what we'll be making?" Ruby ventured. "Does it matter?" Nadia asked.
"But what if they have us making weapons that will be used against the Allies?" Nadia was silent for a moment.
"There are 1,000 women waiting behind us. If we don't take the jobs, someone else will. At least you and I will have a chance of sabotaging the work."
Ruby looked up sharply. "Sabotage? I thought you were talking about saving my baby."
"I am," Nadia said, her eyes sparkling. "But we do what we can to fight the war."
Their interviews were with a man called Herr Hartmann, a German civilian who oversaw part of the assembly line. He was about the age of Ruby's father, and Ruby thought it strange that her first reaction to him was that he had kind eyes. She had come to despise the Germans, but there was something different about Herr Hartmann.
"Why do you want to work here?"
he asked stiffly in French as Ruby sat down with an SS guard lurking in the corner.
I think I have the ability to do a more skilled job than I've been doing at Ravensbrück so far," she said. "I have a university degree and a bit of technical experience."
The last part was a lie, but she knew he wouldn't be able to check the veracity of her words.
"A university degree? From where?" "Barnard College in New York." "Are you American?"
She nodded. "I married a Frenchman before the war and moved to Paris, but yes, I was born in California." He leaned forward, switching to English.
I would very much like to go to America someday.
They exchanged a look before Herr Hartmann blinked and glanced at the guard.
In any case, the job here is on an assembly line. Do you think you can handle taking orders and working with machinery?
Yes, sir. She paused. Your English is quite good.
Thank you, he said. He gave her a sad smile. I took courses in English literature long ago. I was a university professor once upon a time.
The war has changed us all, Ruby said softly.
Herr Hartmann nodded. Yes, I look in the mirror and feel I hardly know myself anymore.
She knew as she left the interview that she would get the job. Chapter 40 July 1944 Nadia and Ruby began work at the Siemens factory the following Monday. Though the job was somewhat easier than the physical labor of the dunes had been, it was still grueling. The women sat at their stations for 12 hours a day, hands numb and bleeding, eyes bloodshot and raw. Ruby realized quickly that they didn't need the specialized technical skills Herr Hartmann had claimed. They were assembling electrical parts to be used in rockets, and they needed only to be able to follow basic instructions. Ruby imagined, as she worked, that she might be building an electrical component for a weapon that would be fired at Thomas's base in England, that somehow she would be responsible for both saving him and destroying him in the same lifetime. So when Nadia showed her how to solder the parts loosely so that there was a chance the circuits would short out, she was an eager pupil.
You must insert everything properly so that the Germans don't notice, Nadia explained patiently. But there's still room to tinker.
Ruby could have sworn that Herr Hartmann knew what they were doing, but the man never said anything. On the contrary, in front of the guards, he treated the prisoners like the slaves they had become, ignoring them almost entirely except to coldly correct the construction of a part here and there. But there were corners in the factory where the guards rarely ventured, and Ruby soon learned that if she carried her electrical components there as if on an errand, Herr Hartmann would often be waiting, eager to have a chat. It turned out that he was horrified at the lack of humanity being shown to Ruby and the others. He would whisper questions.
Why did they shave your heads? What happens to the women who are too frail to work? How much do they feed you?
And his face would grow paler with each answer. In her third week at the factory, Herr Hartmann pulled Ruby aside and asked if she'd like him to send a letter for her.
Your family must be very worried about you, he said.
She wondered for a split second if it was a trap, a false invitation designed to bait her into breaking the rules. But his eyes were as kind as ever, and after a moment, she whispered,
Yes, her heart soaring.
To know that there was at least a chance she'd be able to get word to her parents would be worth the risk. But I don't have any paper or a pen. He assured her he would provide both the following day. True to his word, he slipped her two sheets of paper and a pen on her visit to the corner the next morning, and that night, while her two bunkmates slept, she wrote by the light of the moon. She kept the letter light and devoid of most personal information and negative commentary, because there was always the chance that it would be confiscated.
Dearest mother and father,
words cannot express how much I miss the both of you. I think of you all the time, and I dream of the day I'll be able to see you again. In the interim, please know I'm all right. I am in a prison camp in Germany at the moment, but you mustn't worry. Marcel died in 1941, but my cousin is in good health. She's 15 years old now, in fact. She can explain everything to you. Please do all you can to bring her to the States and to look after her if something should happen to me. Until we meet again, please know that it is my thoughts of you and of home that sustain me. My deepest love always, Ruby. She knew she couldn't mention the baby, and she debated for at least an hour before deciding to include the verbiage about a cousin. She knew it would baffle her parents, but she hoped that if she were to perish in Germany, Charlotte would somehow find her way to them, and that they would understand who the girl was and how much Ruby had loved her.
To mention any more, though, would be to put Charlotte in danger. Thinking of Charlotte was painful. At least Ruby could fight to the death to protect the baby in her womb. Charlotte, by contrast,